Succession number 20342, Reel 1.
Dave McCutcheon, Reel 1. Where were you born, please?
I was born in Belfast, Northern Ireland.
Which year was this?
1930.
Did you grow up and have your schooling in Northern Ireland, in Belfast?
I did. I left Belfast in 1939 and went to a place called Omagh. And there I stayed until I joined the army in 1948.
So most of your schooling was in Omagh?
That's right.
Which school did you go to there?
I went to the ordinary public elementary school.
And how old were you when you left?
I was, when I left school, I was 15.
So that was just as the war was ended?
That was just as the war ended.
Did the Second World War affect you in any way in Northern Ireland?
Not really. The only thing we ever came across was the odd bombing raid, which seemed to slip through occasionally, but there was nothing really devastating about it. We were very lucky.
Were you in any bombing yourself?
I was in one raid on Belfast, which the only thing was, like, incendiary bombs were dropping. And I remember coming across the street to get milk, to make tea. And these things were floating down, and the air raid wardens were running around putting buckets of sand on them to douse them.
What street was this?
This was D Street, off Newton Ards Road. It's all, well, you can look down D Street and see the shipyards. Harland and Wolff shipyards were about 150 yards away from where I lived.
So you lived in D Street?
I lived in D Street, yeah.
Was there any damage in D Street?
There was quite a lot of damage because the Germans seemed to have it in their mind that most churches in Northern Ireland were used as ammunition dumps. And a lot of the churches were totally bombed out during that period.
How did public morale stand up to the raids?
At the time it was a bit on the down, but gradually as time wore on, people got more resilient and said, no, they can't do anything to harm us.
Did you ever think the Germans might win the war?
At one time we were a bit worried. When they started bombing the shipyards, and there were several heavy raids on there, we thought, you know, they could quite easily overrun the place. Being so near the French coast as well, it wasn't a big jump across for them.
Was much damage done to shipyards?
Yes, there was quite a lot done to shipyards. They were there working night and day trying to keep everything up to scratch because there were several of the big ships, the capital ships, were in there for repairs and they couldn't use the anti-aircraft weapons because they were so heavy. And they would have probably done more damage than the Germans.
Had your father worked in the shipyards?
Yes, he'd worked early on, but he had been ill for a long time, the effects of the Second World War. And he died in 1940.
What effects?
Well, it was the effect of the war was gassing. And he managed to struggle through from the First World War through to the Second World War, and then it was just all too much, and he passed on.
Any other memories you've got from the Second World War?
Not really. I spent the latter part of it down on a farm in County Tyrone in Omagh. I had an uncle who lived down there, and I went down to that farm and I stayed there. And we didn't get on very well. It was natural for young ones and old ones. So one morning I got up very early, jumped on the local bus and finished up in the town of Omagh itself. And there I joined the Royal Enniskillen Fusiliers. I hadn't quite made 18, but nobody knew that.
Did they readily accept you?
Yes, they did. Because I had all my father's documents, and that seemed to stand me in good stead. And then they found out that I belonged to the pipe band, the local pipe band, which was belonged to an Orange Lodge, and I could play the pipes. So I was drafted into the Royal Ulster Rifles pipe band. And from that, that was life.
So this was 1947?
Yep. Coming up on 1948, and we left Belfast as a battalion to go to Colchester.
What terms did you sign on for?
I signed on for 5 and 7 at that time.
Did you do the basic training at
Colchester? Oh, yes, I'd done the basic training at Ballykinler, across the ranges there.
What was that like?
Rough. They had all sorts of training going on there, running across mortar ranges. The battalion loved to have cross-country runs 2 or 3 times a week, right across the sand dunes. And you used to go out of one barrack gate, go halfway along the beach, and you had a round rubber stamp stamped on your hand. And when you got to the other end to come back, you got a square stamp on the other hand. And if you come into camp without a round and a square stamp, you were sent back around the course. So there was no fiddling. You had to be able to do it.
Were you fit yourself at that
time? Oh yeah, very fit. Yes, they did believe in keeping up the fitness level very high.
How did the people in charge of the training treat you?
What you would expect of an infantry regiment. Get on with it and don't slack. If you slack, then you are in real trouble. But as long as you work at it, there's no problem at all. Normally, all the NCOs and that were very good. There was just the odd one here and there, but you sort of stayed out of the way if you could.
Did you have any grievances about your treatment?
No, no, there wasn't any point because nobody would listen to you. Yeah.
What happened when you went to Colchester?
Well, we come over to Colchester, and the first thing we got was a lecture by our pipe major on the evils of the English female. Not to have anything to do with them at all. Keep your money in your pocket and stay in camp. Yeah. So I think altogether there was probably something like about 40 to 45 people got married to girls in Colchester.
What were supposed to be the evils of the English female?
Well, they would take your money and leave you flat broke every week. So, of course, some of us did take a little bit of notice of that and, you know, keep them at arm's length until they inveigled their way in. And then you find out that they weren't quite as bad as they were made to be. Yeah.
What did the boys think of this advice?
It was okay, but we had Americans stationed here. And it used to cause all sorts of uproar. British soldiers, American soldiers, and they're all trying to get into the local corn exchange for a dance. And there's more punch-ups and bodies being carried out. Yeah.
Were you in any punch-ups?
No, I kept well out of the way. The only time I got into a punch-up when I was drafted into the regimental police and I was sent in. And we had two standing at the top of the stairs throwing the bodies out. We grabbed them at the bottom and threw them in the back of a 1500 weight. But the trouble was, by the time they got back to camp, they'd all disappeared. Yeah.
Where did they disappear to?
Well, everywhere and anywhere. I mean, it was about a mile back to the camp, and all that happened was the regimental police used to put the straps on the covers and strap everybody sort of underneath, and somebody would get a knife and cut it and hop out, and away they'd go. And then they'd be back in camp. I mean, we had one case of a chap by the name of Kelly. He went out one evening with us. We were in the boxing team at the time, and we went to a pub called the Wagon and Horses. When it come to 11 o'clock, we had to be in for 12. Come to 11, everybody was saying, right, let's all get together, get back into camp before the CSM grabs hold of us or we'll be in trouble. So we went, who's here and who's there and anybody missing? Yeah, Kelly's missing. And we said, well, where the heck is he? And somebody said, well, he went into the Wagon and Horses and he never come out. So everybody sort of went in through the toilets everywhere. Went back to camp when we couldn't find him. And we asked the guard commander, has Kelly booked in yet? And he had a look on the booking in sheet and he said, no, he hasn't. Everybody else is practically in except him. So we went to, up to the billet. We're all sitting around sort of thing. Where the dickens could he have got to? We all went to bed. About 4 o'clock in the morning, there was a hell of a racket. And this bloke, Kelly, was brought in by two RMPs. And what he had done, he'd come out of the pub, walked down the high street, and there was a police car sitting there. He opened the back door of the police car, climbed in, lay down on the floor. The police car was out in the country somewhere, miles away from anywhere, and Kelly reached up over the back and tapped this policeman on the shoulder and said, where are we, mate? The poor bloke nearly had chickens there and then. And this was 4 o'clock in the morning. And he got away with it. He was lucky. That's the sort of tricks he used to get up to there.
Had he thought he was a taxi or something?
Well, the bloke in the car said, he said, I must have grew 6 foot tall. He said, I just took off, he said. He said, it's a good job there's nothing coming the other way, he said, or I'd have probably run into it. Yeah. And then, of course, the talk then was that we were going to go to Korea. We were supposed to be going to Kenya, out there. And they called us out on the square, and they said, gentlemen, you're going abroad to a place that starts with K. Does anybody know? And we all said, well, how the devil should we know? You know, we're not supposed to be the brains of the outfit. And they said, well, you're going to a place called Korea. Does anybody know where it is? And we all looked totally flabbergasted. We hadn't got a clue where it was. In actual fact, some of the lads went down to the library, the army library, and raked through different books there. And then we finally finished up with one chap who had actually been a prisoner of war there. He had been captured by the Japanese. And he told us all about it, and his resume of what went on wasn't very pleasant. So we didn't know what we were letting ourselves in for there. But it took us from the 1st of October to the 5th of November, Guy Fawkes Day. And I'll tell you what, if they'd have been holding a Guy Fawkes party, it would have been washed away. I've never saw rain come down like it. It absolutely fell down. And there was this big American black band, all Negroes, all these different flipping instruments all playing on the quayside there. And it was absolutely belting down. It didn't give us a very good impression of it at all. And then they loaded us on trucks at Pusan, and it took us 5 days to go to a place called Taegu. And what happened was the train had to stop every so often to load firewood on. It was all cutting big cords along the track. So many men had to go down and load the tender up. And then somebody else had to go and get water. And it took 5 days to cover 300 miles. So that was some train journey. And the thing was, when the cooks got the food cooked, they used to shout, "Come and get it." And you could jump off the last truck, run up forward, get your food. You stood to one side, let the trucks go sailing past you, and as yours come along, you jump back on again. That's how fast it went.
Yeah.
And then, of course, we had the winter to contend with as it got wet and it got cold. And I have never, ever been so cold in all my life.
Could you do anything against it?
Pardon?
Could you do anything against it?
There wasn't much you could do about it. You'd only got your equipment. And the other thing was, you try and pick up old sleeping bags and bits and pieces of wreckage here, there and everywhere and make the best you could out of it. Because our clothing wasn't all that up to the mark as such. But then when the cold come, we had a captain, I think it was Captain Smith. He was an amateur meteorologist. And we were called up on Christmas Day, 1950. We had to pipe the dinner in to the mess. We were in reserve. So they said, right, the pipers will play the dinner in as usual. It was 26 degrees below zero. I'll tell you what, my knees, there's lumps of ice chipping off them as they were knocking. But it was absolutely perishing. And we did this, and fortunately the QM gave us a good tot of rum afterwards. That sort of brought a little bit of life back.
What kind of pipes did you play?
Bagpipes.
Where had you learned to play those?
I learned to play those in Ireland when I was a youngster. And that's how I finished up playing in the army.
Were you a good piper?
Well, let's say I passed. Everybody who pipes has got the idea that they could be better. That's one of those things that you pick up and you can get very good at it. You read the music and whatnot, but being expert at it is a different matter altogether. You've got to really work and work and work every minute.
Are they the same as Scotch bagpipes?
They're similar to Scotch bagpipes, except the only difference is where the Scotch have got three drones over the shoulder, the Irish have only got two.
What difference does that make?
Well, it's just the difference in sound when they're tuned. It's a slightly less harsh, sharp sound.
The Irish ones are
The Irish are softer. Yeah. But you play them exactly the same as a Scotch. Yeah.
How many pipers would you have in the battalion?
Well, we only had six. That was one for each company. So if you're going out on a route march somewhere, you were designated for a certain company, to go to a certain company. In fact, I had a photograph this morning where I was doing a route march through Colombo with a chap who was the best man at my wedding, Sammy Thompson.
And I think you were telling me earlier that you had another role apart from piping.
Oh, yeah, well, I was a stretcher bearer. The role in the army is if you're a piper, you always finish up as a stretcher bearer. So you go on different courses and whatnot for stretcher bearing, but usually it's a case of grab them up, get them out of it as quickly as possible, and somebody stick a bandage on them.
Do you have to know first aid?
Well, you're supposed to, but you never have time. Yeah.
Never have time to give them it.
It's not a good time to stop and say, well, look, you could do with an injection. Yeah.
So you're up to Christmas.
Yeah.
Christmas celebrations.
Yeah.
At Tego, is it?
No, we were up at Christmas was just above Seoul. It was a place called Happy Valley. I should have brought those photographs. You could have seen them. And at Happy Valley, a few days later, that's when the Chinese attacked on the 3rd and 4th of January in the new year, 1951.
Can you take me through the details, in as much detail as you can, of what happened to you on that occasion?
Well, it was a case of being up with the companies, getting sent to the different regimental aid posts, helping to get people out of the way and cart them back and send them off to the first aid stations. But you never had time to sort of sit around waiting and watching. And then, of course, the panic stations set in when the Chinese really attacked in force. And we had to get out of it as best we could. People were just cutting across country. You were told, get out now. Don't hang on any longer.
Did people obey that?
Yes, of course they did. Yeah. I mean, there was Chinese blowing bugles and firing weapons off. It was like the 4th of July.
Had you taken many casualties back?
We had. I think that night, the 3rd and 4th, I think we had casualties of somewhere in the region of about 150. The trouble was, you can never be certain what the final number is going to be unless somebody actually goes round and can tell you who it is. Because on the particular day, you'll get somebody who's swanned off somewhere and got injured or killed or whatever, and you don't know nothing about them. I mean, when we met up after the 3rd and 4th of January, people were coming along and saying, here, have you seen Tom so-and-so? Have you seen Jimmy so-and-so? And people were saying, no, I didn't see him. The last time I saw him, he was such and such a place, or he was with so-and-so. And it's a job to know exactly.
Did the casualties have a rough time on the stretchers?
Of course they did. It was freezing cold. I mean, it was really freezing. That was the trouble there. I mean, I've seen people who have had bad cuts, and after about 20 minutes in the cold, it actually congeals. We had it one time. It was so cold. I think it was the REMI department, they came round with all our water, with a lot of water bottles, and they used to say, tip what you've got in your water bottle into this canister and take some out of this one. And what it was, they were putting in half petrol and half rifle oil. So when you got it in your pull through and that, you pulled it through your rifle, but what you had to watch was, the next time you fired the rifle, that there wasn't a flame about 18 inches long coming out of it. It would give you away right away. Wow. But it was the only way they could keep the stuff flowing, moving about. I mean, rifle oil used to freeze solid. Yeah.
Was it a frightening situation in Happy Valley?
Well, of course it was, yeah, because you could never be sure exactly what was going to come in next.
Could you actually see the Chinese?
Oh, yeah, yeah. Yes, they were all done up in their little K-pop suits and what have you.
Were any captured?
Yeah, there was quite a few of them captured. But they weren't held on to too long. If they were a bit of a nuisance, chase them out of it. They never hung around very long, I can assure you. Yeah.
Did you see any close up?
Oh, yeah, I've seen them close up. But they never took an awful lot of notice of us. The only thing they were interested in was watching what the officer types were doing. I think they would have been quite content to sit down on the side of the road and forget everything, just leave them to it.
What do you mean?
Well, they weren't interested in fighting, really. I mean, we used to think that they were really hopped up with drugs and whatnot, but I don't think they were. I think it was the hype that the officer type gave them. You know, you've got to do this for the, I don't know whether it's the motherland or the fatherland and what have you. And they were really trying to drive them on. I mean, the officers used to get behind them and threaten to shoot them if they didn't go forward. So what sort of a system do you get out of that? And then when MacArthur decided to go for the Yalu River, I mean, that was horrendous. We roared up there, no organization whatsoever, and the last time I remember was in Pyongyang, in the northern capital, Pyongyang. The Americans there were saying, right, everybody get out. Take what you want. It doesn't matter what it is. And they had drum kits, orchestras, everything, food, clothing, you name it. And I remember on one occasion I helped to load up a 1,500 weight lorry full of coffee and sugar. It was absolutely jam-packed. And what they'd done was, they put charges along all these railway lines and blew the lot up. There must have been, well, hundreds of thousands of pounds worth of stores went up.
So this was all stuff brought from America?
This was all brought from America. And they rushed it up there as quickly as they could. I mean, you could have got a full set of orchestra instruments out of some of the carriages there.
Did you take anything yourself?
No. The only thing I was interested in was a decent pair of boots.
Did you not have decent boots?
Well, the British Army boots, after you'd worn them for a while, they just fell apart because everywhere was so wet. The Americans had better type boots. I mean, some of the boots we were wearing was Second World War stuff. Ridiculous it was.
Did you get any American boots?
Yeah, I got a lovely pair of American boots. But they didn't last very long either.
Where did you get those?
I got them out of a dump. It was on the side of the rail track. And you could get fur-lined jackets, fur-lined hats, massive great gauntlets.
Is this at Pyongyang?
At Pyongyang, yeah. And they just blew the lot up and set them on fire. Yeah. A total waste of time. There's no organization for anything like that. What it was, it seemed as though we had been transferred from one world to another. It was a totally different world.
How do you mean a totally different world?
Well, the system whereby our people sent us out there and said, right, this is the best equipment we can give you. And it was rubbish, the equipment. Quite frankly, it was rubbish. And there's no organization, anybody to tell somebody, you know, we've got to do this or we've got to do that. It was a hit and miss affair.
What about the military equipment that you had?
The only good equipment we had was the 303 Lee Enfield. That was the only weapon you could depend on. The Sten guns, they pull the trigger on them and the ammunition used to just drop out of the breech. It was a terrible weapon. Totally useless. And they used to get frozen up just as easy as anything.
And mortars?
We had mortars, yeah, but